Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Today's guest says, always keep your sense of humor no matter what life throws at you, and never underestimate the power of a great pair of shoes. Amen on that one. Well, my guest today is debut novelist Eileen Patricia Curran and her new book, Hungry Hill. It's set in Springfield, Massachusetts. It's a story that navigates the complexities of love and how it endures in many forms. It explores our desire to live a life of connectedness. New York Times bestselling author Charlotte Hughes says, Curran delivers a stunning read, both humorous and gut-wrenching, with characters so real they grab hold of your heart. I suspect this gifted new author will be around for a long time. And I do too. And you know, they say never buy a book for its cover, but I know I've done that many times, and I suspect you have too. And I mention that because at some point in our conversation today, we talk about my guest's publishing journey, and specifically why she chose to go the independent author route versus go through the traditional publishing channels. And one of those reasons was to have full creative control. And she has a beautiful book design here, which she worked on with a designer. So it's kind of interesting for anyone who is considering, you know, do I go trad or do I go independent? All right, let me tell you a little bit about my guest. Eileen Patricia Curran was born in Massachusetts and spent much of her childhood in Connecticut. She has degrees in economics and finance, marketing, and interior design. And she currently lives in Florida, the place she calls the Land of Weirdness, where she's perpetually amazed by the local headlines. And the book again is Hungry Hill. And here's my guest, Eileen Patricia Curran. Eileen Patricia Curran, welcome to the show. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Vicki. I'm really happy to be here.
It's always exciting to have a debut author with us because people are always, as you said on your website, you're always looking for the next great read, and listeners are too. But before we dive into the book, Hungry Hill, I want to just talk a little bit about you and who you are with our listeners. Tell us a little bit about what you got to this point. I know you have degrees in finance and marketing and also design, but what have you been focusing on the past few years to lead to this point?
Well, you know, it's the thing that has led me to actually write novel-length fiction is the fact that my life, my professional life pretty much ended when I adopted my son 23 years ago, and I retired to be essentially a soccer mom, and I started flipping houses, and it was very physical work, and I love gardening and landscaping, and I got so caught up in being physical that I felt like I needed to do something intellectual, so I started writing short stories and poetry and decided that I wanted to take on the challenge of writing novel-length fiction.
Very good. And so the book is called Hungry Hill. As we said, it's your debut novel. It explores renewed kinship, complexities of love, the enduring strength of emotional ties, and that connection we long for. So let's give a short synopsis of the book to our listeners. And protagonist Grace Kavanagh is described as intelligent, kind. She's a bit of a smarty pants, but she's also completely lost and just a little crazy. So tell us why. Give us a synopsis of the story.
Well, Grace is a successful architect who's married to a wonderful man, Michael, who's very creative and bright, and she's very much in love with him. And they have a wonderful life together. And he suddenly dies, and she is so devastated by the loss that she does not know what to do with herself. And I've never experienced that degree of loss, but I really tried hard to imagine what would happen if you didn't get any traction whatsoever in moving on with your life. And that is what happens to Grace Kavanaugh. And when she's bottoming out, she gets a call from her great aunt Maggie, who lives in Hungry Hill, which is it's an Irish Catholic neighborhood in Springfield, Massachusetts. And I chose the setting because that's where my dad and my grandfather grew up. And it was familiar to me. And being a debut author, I really thought it would be helpful to draw on a setting that I felt I could imagine in my mind and take it somewhere. So that's why I wrote it based in Hungry Hill. And I thought it would be a challenge to write the story. So I decided that that would be my first foray into novel-length fiction.
Very good. And so I think it's always great when you have a great location because it adds to the atmosphere. It becomes another character, if you will. And so that is always an extra layer to a story that I enjoy, and I know a lot of readers do. So how did the idea for this story come to you? And how long did it take to generate? Because, you know, I talk with a lot of people. Sometimes they have an idea of something and it takes 30 years to percolate and then all of a sudden it explodes. Or other times you wake up in the middle of the night and you're like, yes, I have to write this. So how did that work for you?
Well, you know, it's funny because when I was in undergraduate school, I wrote a short story called in creative writing. So most of the classes that weren't in economics and finance were creative. And I wrote a story called The World's Oldest Living Virgin. And it was kind of a character, a fictionalized character study, but I was using my great aunt, Catherine Curran, as the central character, and it just stayed with me. You know, this intriguing, independent, very unique person who had been in my life, who was probably one of the most unique people I had ever met. She just remained with me, and when I was kind of banging around in my head looking for characters to draw on, you know, as a result of writing about her, she immediately came to mind. So I thought, I should use her as a character. If I'm going to use her, then I really need to use the setting that I know her from, which is Hungry Hill. She grew up in the same house my father grew up in. Mm-hmm. And the house was in the family for decades. And so she was a part of that house. She lived in it. She was born, literally born in the house, and lived in it until she died in her late 80s.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you have a character like that gives you so much material to work with, especially when you're just working on an initial novel, I definitely decided to write about her. And then I thought, well, if I want to write in the first person, which is really the only way I'm comfortable writing, and I want to write it from the perspective of someone who's not necessarily me, but someone I understand, I decided to use a great niece and have the two of them interact somehow, and I couldn't quite imagine how they would get together. So I thought for a while about how would you get these two women together so it was meaningful. And I decided that they would both have some sort of life crisis.
Yes.
And not seeing each other for a long time meant that they didn't know each other really well when it happened to the both of them. But they had this family tie that they were both able to draw on. And so Grace decides, after losing her husband, Michael, that she'll go help her great aunt. And she knows that she's stuck, and she knows that she's not making progress, that she still has not even really acknowledged her husband's death, and that she's so stuck that she has to do something. And this seems to be the thing that she needs to do, which is to help her great aunt. So she moves from Greenwich, Connecticut, which is a very upscale town, to Hungry Hill in Springfield, which is very blue collar and working class. And she moves in with her great aunt, Maggie. And they try to figure out how to help each other.
Yes. And, you know, when I was reading the book, you know, I thought, well, it might seem to some people that after losing the love of your life, as Grace lost her husband, Michael, that the last thing you'd want to do is take on being a caregiver to an 86-year-old woman who really needs your help. But I remember a quote by Gandhi that helped me a lot when I was going through a death of a loved one. And it was, the best way to find yourself is to lose yourself in the service of others. And I really took that to heart at the time, and I've kind of carried that through my life from that point. So it makes a lot of sense. It's always interesting how the stories come together, though, right?
And I think that's a really a perfect way of putting it. You know, the loss of a life was so devastating to Grace that the only way she could get beyond it was to really immerse herself in someone else's life and step outside of herself and be there for somebody who meant something to her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think in the novel, it's, you know, a great mechanism for recovery from loss, or at least, you know, it allowed her to process it in a way that was productive and thoughtful and tender and meaningful. And, you know, as the story developed in my head, everything meant something to me. The way they connected and the way they shared almost a sisterly connection. And I drew on my own childhood, I drew on my family. Thinking about the things that have gotten me through difficult times, and very often it is stepping outside of myself and doing something for somebody else, and it just makes what I'm experiencing a lot less bleak. So I wanted that to be a part of the story.
Mm-hmm. And from a storytelling perspective, from the story arc, I mean, this is where you get your growth from, when there's that challenge to overcome adversity in life. But you also, I mean, there are some humorous bits in here. And I love the relationship between Grace and her friend Kat. They have a very easy, very natural connection with each other. And there's one part of the book where they're talking on the phone and Kat says something like, "Oh, Grace, I miss you. Most of my friends are very mature." And I think we all need that friend in life where we can be, you know, immature and as we want to be. So I love the way that you created them and brought them together. And why did you continue those through the book?
The relationship with Kat?
Yeah.
Well, I wanted enough, I won't call it comic relief, but I wanted the reader to see Grace interacting with someone from her old life who knew her well, who understood her sense of humor, who was a part of a life that she didn't have anymore, but she still felt connected to her. So I thought it was a great way to sort of bridge the past and the present by using her old friend. And I love dialogue. You know, I'm kind of a dork myself, so a lot of their interaction and dialogue was very much the way I interact with a lot of my friends, and I thought it would add a warmth to the novel that was really important.
Yes, yeah. And I want to just touch on this because you talked about Hungry Hill, the location, and, you know, you grew up close to it. Your father did, too. But is Hungry Hill the actual real name, or did you fictionalize that name?
I fictionalized a lot about the actual neighborhood, but Hungry Hill is very much a very old Irish Catholic neighborhood in Springfield, Massachusetts. Cleveland Street, where the story takes place, is very real. I do kind of fictionalized features of it, so it's not you know, it's there. It's sort of a nod to my family, but it there are facts about the neighborhood that are not accurate. They're fictionalized. And in fact, the church, the Catholic church that's in the novel, is fictionalized to the extent that I recreated it in my mind. There is a Catholic church there that my great aunt Catherine went to Mass at every day of her life, pretty much. But it's been closed for probably a decade and a half. Mm-hmm. So I wanted that to be a part of the story. So I brought the church into the story fictionalized. But everything about the setting was very much a part of what I grew up with. So when Grace went somewhere, it's somewhere I knew, so I could write about it. And mm-hmm. there was a reason to be there. And they were touchstones for her, I guess, I would say. And so I really wanted the whole neighborhood to feel real. And I hope I did make it feel real. I know people from the area are thrilled to finally have a novel that is based in a setting that is Springfield, Mass., because it really hasn't been the setting for very many novels.
I'm sure, because I have talked to several authors who've written their books up here in the Pacific Northwest. Such a great area, you know, as parts of the East Coast are too, for storytelling, because of the water and
the history
and all that stuff. And people always love when, you know, I have somebody who writes a book about Seattle. I always love it.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
And they recognize the landmarks and they can see themselves there. I don't know about you, but when I read, I love to feel like I'm experiencing something that's real.
Absolutely.
So the more legitimate the setting is, the more real the people feel, the more human the dialogue. And that's probably why I put humor in my writing, because I think, you know, that helps us connect to the writing. But I think the more real things feel, the more connected you get to the writing. I know sometimes I read novels where it's obvious that, you know, they may be great novels and great stories, but it's obvious that the author hasn't really spent time in the location that the novel's set in.
Yeah, it comes across as kind of flat then. You know, you feel, I mean, going to a very simple story with the TV show Murder, She Wrote, the reason that is has been so successful is because, you know, certain people can relate to it and they feel they know this woman and they know the characters and they know the area. So there's a lot to be said for being drawn in there. I read that you're a slow writer. So what does that look like for you? I mean, people define that differently. Some people think if they put out a book a year, they're, you know, quick, and others, that's really slow. So,
well, you know, it took me a couple of years to sort of write my first draft. And then I knew that it needed editing and polishing. So I worked with an editor for like another year and a half. So in writing and rewriting, and I was learning how to write. I mean, writing fiction is a skill.
Mm.
And even though, you know, I'm a voracious reader and I've done a lot of writing involving poetry and prose and short stories and all of that, just for personal pleasure, it's totally different when you're sitting down and trying to create a story arc and you're trying to create characters that feel real. So I found I'm slow because I'll write something and then I'll go back and go, this is not even close to what I want to say. For instance, I really wanted every character in this novel to reflect a kindness and a gentleness in spite of maybe the rough edges of their personality or the things they've been through. So I would sometimes write a chapter and go back and read it and go, you know, that didn't sound kind. It didn't sound it wasn't saying what I wanted it to say.
Right.
And so I would go back and rewrite it just because it was important for me to have the whole story sort of shrouded in kindness. And so that really slowed me down because sometimes I would just get on a rampage, you know. I'd be writing away and the dialogue would get out of hand and I would reread it and go, you know, this is, it's not even close to who I want these people to be. So rethink it, you know.
Well, I actually love that because we certainly need a lot more kindness in our world today.
I agree, and I gravitate to it now. I really do. When I start reading, you know, I think we went through a period where everybody was, you know, trying to shock readers with really crazy protagonists.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of the stories that came out of it were, you know, the intriguing and fun and exciting, but they didn't warm my heart. So I'm not a huge fan of taking your central character and making them do the most god-awful thing you can imagine and running with it, you know?
Right.
So I just, you know, my writing style is very different from that.
So besides that that we just talked about, what were some other challenging aspects of writing this story? I mean, are there areas that you find you struggle with or that you don't enjoy doing?
I would say that, honestly, in the beginning, just the mechanics of writing things in the proper tense, which sounds silly, because we all know when we read something that's done right, but if you're writing a story that's kind of going back in time or layered or it's a brief flashback or whatever, trying to get that right so it feels good when you're reading it was a bit of a challenge. I knew I wanted to do a prologue that was really into the story a bit. So in trying to, you know, write about dreaming and that sequence and all of that, which is something I really wanted to do, and I wanted to challenge myself with it, just getting it right mechanically took some learning on my part. So I feel like I got a real education just writing.
Right.
And working with a really, really good editor and just pushing myself and sitting there with, you know, surrounded by books that I could reference and make sure that I was doing things the way I wanted to do them. So I would say, you know, just as a first-time writer, even someone who's well-educated and well-read, just doing it right mechanically was a challenge.
Yes, yes, definitely. And, you know, it's the eternal argument about prologues. A lot of writers say, absolutely not. And others say, you know, why not? I'm in that why not category because I always read the prologue. I've talked with some writers who say, oh, I never read the prologue. And I'm like, but it's part of the book. And then they'll say, then it should be chapter one. But obviously you wanted the prologue in there. So, and it works.
I
obviously.
Did. Yeah. I did. I thought, you know, the first chapter is quite a bit of nuts and bolts. You know, I'm driving a car, I'm in the neighborhood, I'm looking for the house, I'm banging on the door, this is who my aunt is. You know, it was sort of framing out the location and the characters, and I wanted the reader from the get-go, anyone who bothered to read the prologue, understand that we were talking from or reading from the perspective of someone who was devastated emotionally.
Yeah.
And give them some hint of why they were on this journey to Hungry Hill.
Right.
And what they had been through recently. So from my perspective, after, you know, playing around with structure with a novel, I decided that a prologue would help a reader do that.
Yeah, definitely. And let's talk a little bit about publishing, Eileen, especially since you're a first-time author and authors today have so many choices. You know, self-published, become an indie publisher, try to get an agent and do it the traditional way. Just before we talked, I said how much I like the cover, and you said it's one of the reasons you wanted to be an independent publisher there. So tell us what thought process went into, you know, how you were going to handle the publishing end of things and why.
Well, you know, it's funny. I think a lot of people during COVID decided to take on projects that they had shelved. And I had worked with a couple of agents, and I had a lot of encouragement. And I thought, you know, I may just want to plow ahead and see if I can get a publisher. And then I thought, you know, I really want to do this my way, and I'm writing for the pleasure of it. And I love an intellectual challenge, and I knew it would be very hard to figure out how to be an independent author because there are so many moving parts. And I think if I had known in the beginning how many moving parts, I might have not taken on the challenge. But I have to say, I absolutely loved finding, you know, an interior book designer and working with him. He's just this wonderful young man in The Hague in the Netherlands. And so we were like completely off schedule, but it was like a little present on my computer when I get up in the morning and he would have completed something I asked him to do. Mm. And that was so much fun. So designing the interior was fun. I had a lot of ideas about my book cover. I'm one of those people who definitely very often just buys a book because it's pretty.
Oh, me too.
You know, and I just assume it's going to be good because it's got a great cover. And since I have a strong background in design, I have been obsessed with this trend in wallpaper, sort of this return to wallpaper. And you're going to laugh, but I don't know if you know anything about cottagecore, but it's a very hot trend right now where we're going back to Little House on the Prairie and floral dresses and lots of ruffles. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to the point that a lot of the major designers are doing, like, patchwork suits now, and it's a little weird, and if you haven't cued into it, then you could easily just go, well, that was weird. But if you get obsessed with it like I am, you want your book cover to be a little cottagecore with the wallpaper theme. So I kind of went a little crazy with that because there's so many resources now. I mean, I could spend my life looking at different websites that have images that you can select with. And I decided I wanted to do a wallpaper that was custom.
Right.
And I'm very, you know, and I'm very particular about color, and everything about the cover of the book was important to me. So I actually went through a couple of book cover designers. And the second one that I worked with just totally got what I was going for. And she's wonderful. She did a beautiful job. And that was so much fun. The whole design process. And then doing my website was so much fun. And I spent hours and hours trying to make it not look like a typical author's website. I wanted something that kind of told a story, and I had these great images in my mind, and there are artists that I follow that use the perspective of the individual sitting in the painting or photograph or whatever, where you just see their back.
Yeah.
And you're looking at what they're looking at.
Yeah.
And I thought that would be great for a storyteller's website because you would be sitting there looking at what's going on, and it would create its own little story. So I worked on my website with that creative thing in mind. And a lot of this stuff I couldn't have done if I had worked with a traditional publisher. I would have pretty much been given probably a few options and maybe involved in the creative process a little bit, but it wouldn't have been my baby. And I really love doing all of that.
Right. And maybe none at all, because I know often debut authors have very, very, very little say in what things
right.
look like. So, but how much, I mean, you had a background, your degrees were in economics, finance, marketing, design.
Right.
I mean, that must have helped you a lot.
Very much so, especially, you know, my marketing background. You know, I understand the big picture. I understand the challenges. I've educated myself on all the platforms and the resources, and it is really overwhelming, I have to say, even for somebody with an MBA in marketing.
Right.
To try to figure out, you know, Amazon and KDP Publishing and NetGalley and all these different resources that you have to work with if you want to self-publish.
Yeah, because the biggest part of getting your book out there really is distribution, is getting it in the hands of
absolutely.
Readers.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even that is, you know, there are so many differing opinions about the what is the best way to do it. And because I tend to like to keep things simple, and I'm not a huge fan of social media, it's been a challenge for me to distill my marketing efforts down to something I can really enjoy.
Mm.
And to focus on things that work for me, and to not try to make myself do things that I really, really don't like or don't enjoy. And, you know, picking through, there's so many options now. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah. Oh, it's overwhelming. It's overwhelming. I've got, you know, several friends who went from trad publishing to independent, and, you know, the time they spend on all of that stuff is intense. And it's a shock to some, especially if they've been in traditional publishing for 20 years, and then all of a sudden they're like, oh, now I have to do all of this. But I like on the book cover, you've got the protagonist in your book has an Irish wolfhound, and that's the Irish wolfhound on the front, right?
It is. It is. I spent thousands of hours looking at Irish wolfhounds and just getting carried away with their images because I have wanted an Irish wolfhound for as long as I can remember. So part of writing is fun. It's fun to be able to give yourself something that you've always wanted.
Right.
So I gave myself not one, but two Irish wolfhounds. I definitely wanted Ellen, Grace Kavanaugh's Irish wolfhound, to be featured in the wallpaper.
Well, she looks beautiful, and it's all come together really well, extremely professional. I mean, I get a lot of books on my desk, and I can tell instantly whether something's self-published or independently published, usually. And with this one, I could not, so.
Oh, well, good.
Good job.
That's great news. I did try very hard to be polished and professional.
Yeah.
And, you know, I knew what I liked, and I really thought if I put enough effort and thought into things that I could do it.
Yeah.
So it's been really fun.
Yes. I saw on your website that you had a coming soon for your second book, Gatorland. So where are you at with that?
Well, I have the entire story mapped out, and I've been writing it, but I have to say, because I'm focused on Hungry Hill and, you know, marketing and distribution right now, it's taken a back burner, but I can't wait to feel like I've got this kind of under control and I've got things, you know, moving and grooving, and I can step away from the day-to-day stuff with Hungry Hill and go back to writing. But I decided when I was writing Hungry Hill that I loved the humor. And I thought originally I wanted to be a very literary writer with lots of beautiful prose. And I love to describe things. And I thought that's where I wanted to go, and to dig deep emotionally and write not the great American novel, but, you know, something really respectful. And I found that I really like the humor.
Well, I think you've written something very respectful regardless. So tell us, I know I have to let you go soon, but tell us what you learned as a first-time author through the process of your writing, because, you know, we change our focus from the beginning to the end of a book and all those many rewrites that we have to go through. What's one thing that you learned through that whole process that you will carry forward with you to make the next book easier to write, hopefully?
I think I've learned that you just have to be determined to do a good job and to keep at it and to learn from your mistakes, recover from them, rewrite, and just keep working at it. So I know my next novel is not going to be easy, and it will probably take me a while to write it, but I at least learned that by being determined to finish and to do it well, that I could do it, and I'm bringing that with me to my next novel.
Well, I love it. The book is called Hungry Hill. My guest, Eileen Patricia Curran. And I know you can find out more about Eileen at her website, eileenpatriciacurran.com. Final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, Eileen?
I hope that they will buy and read and review my novel. It is, you know, a very important part of what I'm trying to accomplish this summer.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate your time and enjoyed learning about your debut journey, if you will.
Thank you very much, Vicki. I really appreciate it. It's been fun.
And I just want to thank everyone for joining us today. Questions, comments, or feedback on today's show, you can find me through our website at conversationslive.net. Please join us next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.